Thank you, and thanks to the organizers for the invitation to attend this very stimulating meeting. I don't need to review the information paradox for all of you, but I'll remind you that it appears to present a conflict between fundamental principles underlying local quantum field theory, the principles of relativity, the principles of quantum mechanics, and the principle of locality. And of course, that's why it's so interesting, because it's telling us that there's something wrong with one or more of these principles, and we need to somehow modify them. In fact, I've argued for some time that to me it seems like this problem, this conflict, is analogous to that of the hydrogen atom and attempting to describe it within classical physics. That pushed us, of course, to new principles. And so, you know, trying to explain the black hole should play a key role in ultimately helping us to infer the fundamental physics of gravity. One other reminder about those principles and their role, these principles basically imply the structure of local quantum field theory. In other words, you don't need to, you know, solve the problem of reconciling these principles and then introduce quantum fields. Quantum field theory comes from reconciling those principles. Once you've done that, you basically end up with the structure of local quantum field theory. That's essentially a folk theorem. of course, just involving special relativity. Moreover, another reminder, if you start with local quantum field theory and specify the symmetries, say the symmetries of the standard model and the fermion, well, the matter representations, you basically have the standard model. You don't have to separately introduce stuff like electrons and so on. You're just basically spelling out what the representations and the matter what the gauge groups are and the representations are, and then, you know, you have the whole thing. So from my point of view, we should be going after the principles that accommodate gravity, and once we've done that, we ultimately expect to have the correct quantum structure, and again, I think black holes should supply critical clues to this problem. So how do we approach specifically the problem of black holes? Well, quantum mechanics is well tested and it seems to be very hard to modify. So I'm going to assume we're going to work within a quantum mechanical framework. On the other hand, locality is difficult to precisely formulate in quantum gravity and is suspect. But we need something like it, and here's a weakened version. Let's imagine that a black hole is another kind of quantum subsystem of a quantum system, the bigger universe, at least to a good approximation. That's a weaker notion of locality. Likewise, for the environment, that's also a quantum subsystem of the bigger quantum system. So we're at least going to assume we have that much locality. And in fact, I'll write down a set of working postulates, not yet at the level of fundamental principles, but some postulates for trying to address the explanation of black holes. And I'm going to, you know, take the viewpoint that physics should be, good physics is radically conservative, or, you know, often as conservative as possible, but in certain cases you're forced to be somewhat radical. And this really does seem to be a circumstance like that. I'll try to be as conservative as I can, so let's stick with quantum mechanics. At least this coarsened notion of subsystems, their subtleties in gravity, which there isn't time to go into. And then,
Steve, can you explain what you mean by a subsystem?
Ordinarily in finite quantum systems, I mean a factorization of the Hilbert space into tensor factors. It's more subtle. That's a separate discussion. We could talk about that afterwards.
But I could think about it at the moment as a separate.
Think of it as a tensor factor of Hilbert. In practice, that's roughly the structure we'll use. And then finally, a third postulate that I'd like to work with is the statement that we should match on to, at least approximately, the description given by local quantum field theory. And in particular, for describing the observations of people who might be crossing big horizons. And so this is, you know, the statement of, so to speak, nonviolence. And of course, it's a big challenge to see whether, even at this level, these three principles can be reconciled. So either way, the answer is interesting. So let me try to be a little more concrete and first talk about all of this in the just the local quantum field theory context. So a picture of a black hole with some set of slices. And one way to think about the subsystems there, again, just in local quantum field theory, is I divide things into, you know, outside the dotted line and inside the dotted line. I could just as well put the radius at which I divide things into the inside and outside subsystem at the horizon. That's commonly done. Or I could even put it inside the horizon at some radius that's still, you know, large as compared to the Planck scale. And in practice, I'll do that. And so then in local quantum field theory, I can take the Hamiltonian, and I could be very explicit if there were more time, but let me just be schematic. I could take the Hamiltonian and write it as a piece that evolves, you know, the inside subsystem, a piece that evolves the outside subsystem, and a coupling between the two that basically transfers information across the dotted line. That's the last term, H sub I. And in fact, this evolution, local quantum field theory evolution, is unitary on these slices as long as we don't allow the black hole to shrink. Effectively, we can put the, well, Newton's constant equal to zero and ignore any back reaction. But as we know, if we do allow the black hole to shrink, then ultimately unitarity will fail. So we violate postulate one that we have unitary evolution. And let's just remind ourselves of the...
The space-time you're looking at r equal to zero, is geodesically incomplete.
That's why I'm avoiding it. Let's just look at these slices, and you can choose that set of slices. Those are spatial slices, and you can evolve on them, and
but
there's a unitary evolution operator.
Try to complete it beyond r equal to zero.
We could choose, so effectively I'm choosing a choice of gauge by choosing a choice of slicing. And you know, certainly with this choice of slicing, I have unitary evolution. I can write down for you the Hamiltonian, the evolution operator, everything. We can do it afterwards, but you can do
but
it.
Automatically you will have unitarity violation because things will disappear at the singularity.
No, what they do is they freeze at this inner radius here where these slices stop. Because the lapse goes to zero there, so evolution stops. More detail in the discussion. We don't have time to go through that.
How about you disagree with that?
Okay. It's just true. I can show you. They never get to r equals zero. Okay, so the what is the problem? So the problem is that unitarity, as we know, fails, violating postulate one when you include the back reaction, when you turn on Newton's constant. And that arises from two related issues. One is that local quantum field theory evolution only increases the entanglement between the black hole subsystem and the environment, both through buildup of entanglement via Hawking radiation, and also just because you can transfer information into the black hole. You can make a Bell pair outside and drop one partner in. Secondly, and relatedly, the black hole subsystem has an unboundedly large dimension, so you can store arbitrarily large amount of information or build up arbitrarily large amount of entanglement. But then when the black hole disappears, unitarity is violated because you basically lose that subsystem. So some kind of modification of this story is needed if we're going to have a unitary description. Okay, so let's try to just follow our postulates to attempt to infer what modifications are needed. So again, postulate two is that we have subsystems, black hole and environment. And to respect unitarity, we have to address these preceding problems. So first, we need some way, namely a new term in the Hamiltonian that will transfer entanglement or information from the black hole subsystem to the environment. You just need that for unitarity. Secondly, you don't only need the ability or the presence of interactions that allow transfer, but also you need effectively the black hole Hilbert space to shrink as the black hole evaporates to, in effect, push the information out. So let's say that there are some finite number of states in a range of masses of order 1 over r given by the black hole entropy, whatever it is, could be Bekenstein-Hawking. So schematically, the states look like this. You have the discrete states of the black hole subsystem, and then the states of the environment, which are approximately described in local quantum field theory at a given time, working in, say, Schrodinger picture. And this extra term has to be able to transfer entanglement or information from one to the other. And at a rate of order 1 qubit per light crossing time to basically to beat the Hawking radiation. Okay, so I've assumed subsystems and Hamiltonian evolution, but what about this third postulate that we want to match onto local quantum field theory? So I've said the environment I'd like to imagine is approximately described via local quantum field theory. We'll be agnostic about the nature of the Hamiltonian acting on the internal degrees of freedom of the black hole. That could be complicated. But what structure do we have that allows you to transfer the information in that extra term in the Hamiltonian? I'm just going to try to describe that or parameterize that in the spirit of effective field theory. So what do we need? Well, we need an operator that acts on the internal system and an operator that acts on the external system coupled together to do this, to transfer information from one to the other. And then we can imagine superposing those with some arbitrary coefficients, which basically are just parameterizing our ignorance. So let's talk about constraints on these. Again, the general operator acting on the internal system has a basis, which is just all of the n by n matrices generating the UN transformations on the internal Hilbert space. Okay, so what are some relevant constraints? This kind of interaction could be used to parameterize various scenarios, massive remnants, gravistars, fuzzballs, et cetera, some coupling between internal and external degrees of freedom. But we want more. We want to minimize our departure from local quantum field theory. And what does that tell us about these coefficients? Well, first, they should be supported near the black hole because we don't want to be transferring information to the next galaxy. That would be a big departure from local quantum field theory. On the other hand, we could fine-tune these to be supported, you know, very near the black hole, just a Planck distance outside. But then we would have, in effect, a violent transfer of information in addition to being fine-tuned. So it makes more sense from both of those viewpoints to take these coefficients to have support that extends outside the black hole, say, a distance roughly comparable to the horizon radius. So again, that's the sort of non-violence kind of condition I've described. And so the simplest implementation of this constraint, minimizing the departure from local quantum field theory, is just to assume that the relevant scales that enter into these coefficient functions are all given by the scale we have, the horizon radius, and also we only couple between operators, we only couple black hole states with mass differences of order, also 1 over r. Okay, so at this point, another constraint is we want to be consistent with various Gedanken experiments that involve mining black holes, and also at least approximately with the beautiful story of black hole thermodynamics. Let me address the first. The problem with mining is if I have a black hole that is radiating energy and introduce, say, a cosmic string, the rate at which Hawking evaporates increases. And so if I have an information transfer mechanism, I need that to also transfer information faster so that I don't end up ultimately with a black hole that's evaporated down with a large number of internal states remaining. So I need to match the information transfer rate to the energy transfer rate, basically. And that suggests that the coupling should be universal. We should be able to couple to all of the the degrees of freedom that can live in the vicinity of the black hole. And the simplest way of doing that is if the kind of operator we couple to outside is very special, if we only couple, say, to the stress tensor of the field theory description outside. And so that also keeps, keeps the story close to black hole thermodynamics, although that's harder to really fully describe given the time. But that means that this coupling here, combining these coefficients and the operators acting on the black hole Hilbert space, looks like an effective black hole state-dependent metric perturbation. This is effectively an operator that acts on the black hole Hilbert space. A third condition is that we need sufficient information to transfer. We need a fast enough information transfer rate, as I said. Now, what would easily suffice is if the effective metric perturbation were sort of unity in unit size, and then of course it's varying on distance and timescales of order r. But that tells you that the metric in the vicinity of the black hole, you know, effectively is behaving like a classical metric that's strongly fluctuating. And you might see that, for example, with Event Horizon Telescope. And here's a simulation of the kind of time-dependent distortion of the image that you might find that I've done with Demetrius Saltis. And
That's what it would look like.
Yeah, evolution in time. Yep. And so, you know, that would be pretty spectacular and pretty interesting. We'll see what Event Horizon Telescope brings. But there is a question, you know, are such large effects necessary? So we'll go back to our basic interaction and let's reorganize it a little bit. So these coefficient functions, I can expand in a basis of functions that is actually a small basis because we want things not with really high wave numbers, and we want things that are also localized near the black hole. So there's only a small basis of functions that do that. So we'll expand in terms of that basis, and then we'll combine these coefficients together with the basic transition operators acting on the black hole Hilbert space to write down these operators O gamma, which, you know, act on the black hole Hilbert space. And then these this basis set of functions will integrate again against the stress tensor and pull out a scale of order the basically the Hawking temperature scale to make it dimensionless. And then this interaction Hamiltonian looks like just a simple product of, you know, these operators times those operators summed with this energy scale pulled out. So that's the form of our interaction Hamiltonian. And the number of channels we have for information release is given by the dimension of this basis. So the question is, with that structure, how do we see that sufficient information transfers?
What's the total amount of energy that's stored in this, say, environment?
In the environment. But so the environment.
You have a modified shell.
We have a Hamiltonian, which is the inside piece, plus the outside piece, plus this, basically.
Right. So okay. If you integrate it over a volume.
Oh, you want to know what how much energy this has? Yes. First, I have to say how big it is, and I'm getting there.
Okay,
so how big does it need to be? And so this becomes a problem, you know, purely in quantum information theory. Let's suppose we have two subsystems, one much bigger than the other, with Hamiltonians acting on one or the other and a coupling between the two. Let's suppose the scale of the smaller Hamiltonian is some energy which we pull out of the interaction term. We'll normalize our operators with a, well, to one and a certain convention. And then these interactions are characterized by some dimensionless coupling constant. And the question is, in this kind of setup, how fast do you transfer information? That's the purely information theoretic version of the question of what we were just describing. What do we mean by transfer of information? Well, long story short, we look at, say, entanglement with another auxiliary system and look at the transfer of mutual information. And we want to assume that the Hamiltonian acting on the smaller system is sufficiently random. Let me not go into details. But there's a conjecture about how fast you transfer information that looks like this. It's given, you know, basically by this energy scale, by the sum over all the channels of the coupling squared. This is something that we have been working on checking. It's a work in progress. We've already supplied some evidence for this in a recent paper with Max Rota. And of course, you know, this pertains to a more general problem. But some motivation for that, well, really, it's just Fermi's golden rule, which has already been invoked today. If you have a process of decay, well, that the decay rate is a lot like the information transfer rate. If you think of, say, a decaying atom, then it's effectively transferring information from the states of the atom to the states of the environment, say. And this decay rate goes, well, is given by, say, Fermi's golden rule. And just this alone will give you the power of the energy and tell you about the normalization of the operators and tell you that you have that quadratic dependence on the couplings between the black hole state and the environment. So applied to black holes directly, we find that as long as our operators are normalized properly, just with coefficients of order one, we get the necessary information transfer rate, 1 qubit per light crossing time. But what does this normalization condition amount to for the operators? If we assume these are random matrices, again, we expand in terms of a basis of matrices, n by n basis, then this the correct condition for random matrices is that the operator norm be 1, and that happens if these coefficients are of order 1 over the square root of n. Again, n is the size of the matrix. And that's the same as e to minus the black hole entropy over 2. Put differently, if we go back to the form of these couplings, they're basically couplings between the environment and the transitions between the black hole states, and they can be tiny, but still you transfer information fast enough, contrary to some previous lore and beliefs, although not contradicting anyone's theorem. In fact, again, invoking Fermi's golden rule, it's a similar story that has been invoked in a different context already earlier. You can have tiny couplings times a large number of final states, giving you an order one rate. Okay, that's the basic essence behind this. This also means that if you look at the matrix element of this effective metric perturbation, which again is proportional to those couplings, that will also be tiny. And so that contrasts with the interesting case where you have an order one metric perturbation, which you could see with easily with the event horizon telescope, or potentially you could see with the event horizon telescope. In fact, this is, in comparing these, something like the contrast between coherent oscillation or coherent excitations and incoherent ones. What about observational constraints then? If we don't have effectively large classical fluctuations, what you want to do is try to estimate the rate at which, say, matter scattering off of the black hole is affected. Again, you can use Fermi's golden rule. Again, you, for the same reason, expect to get order one transition, say, probabilities per relevant time. But the typical momentum transfer, because of the scales involved in these couplings, is of order 1 over r. Let's think about what that means. We're looking at, say, with the event horizon telescope, millimeter wavelength light, and we're saying that it can pick up a momentum transfer of order 1 over 10 to the 7 kilometers. That's the horizon radius for Sagittarius A star. So an absolutely tiny effect. On the other hand, there is one case where we are looking at radiation with wavelengths comparable to the black hole size, and that's with LIGO and Virgo in gravitational waves. So that brings me to the last part of my talk, the question of observational possibilities. So let's consider the general situation independent of the postulates I've made. And so first, there's common agreement that reconciling black holes with quantum mechanics requires modifying the story we have at scales of order of the black hole size. And of course, now we're acquiring two observational windows on those scales. So this is something to really think about, as I've been arguing for a while. And one way to start thinking about it is to start to classify scenarios by relevant parameters. How far outside the would-be horizon the departure from the standard story extends, the height of the atmosphere or the more general departure, and there's a similar parameterization by these guys. The scale on which the departure varies, so the hardness of the structure, which has to be less than the previous scale, and of course the nature of the couplings to the other fields. So why are these relevant parameters? Well, these begin to characterize observational effects. Let's think about gravitational wave observations. And if we have two objects that are colliding that have some structure that extend well outside the horizon, well, an example of that is something like a collision of a neutron star. And we didn't see in the recent spectacular observation the relevant regime of the signal, but numerical simulations by some of our friends here show that you know, the further out the hard structure of the neutron star extends, the earlier you get a departure from the black hole merger signal, basically. So you can tell whether or not there's hard structure. Of course, if you're looking at light, you can tell it even more directly by what you see. So we can begin to classify scenarios in terms of, say, these parameters. So we've got the story I've been telling, soft gravitational structure, firewall story where both of these parameters are comparable to the Planck scale, the fuzzball story where at least the hardness scale is microscopic. I haven't seen a definitive statement about non-extremal black holes like Schwarzschild and how far out the structure should extend. It sounds like it's basically being assumed that it's very close to the horizon, but
no,
I'd like
not.
To learn.
I mean, depends
okay.
On
discussion. So, okay, but that's an okay. So I put a question mark there. But in any case, there's an important contrast between soft and hard structure, I think. And fuzzballs do, for example, seem to be hard in the sense that they vary on short distance scales. So hard structure, as I've said, you know, if there's hard structure that extends out far enough, as we saw with the neutron star case, in fact, you can rule it out by the fact that, for example, in the first detection, we saw the nice expected signal, you know, all the way up to merger. So there's some, I think, statement that can be made here ruling out, you know, sufficiently long-scale hard structure. On the other hand, as we know, the firewall story is harder to rule out or test because everything's very near to the horizon, unless this echo story, well, really serves as a test. One must assume that whatever new object is forming is rapidly forming, rapidly enough to affect the gravity wave signal. And then finally, as I've mentioned, soft gravitational structure potentially has effects on the gravity wave signal, but still a little bit more needs to be done. So there's an important contrast here between the issue of electromagnetic images versus gravity wave images. You know, with electromagnetic images, we're just taking a picture, in effect, of the black hole surroundings. But for gravitational waves, we really need the full dynamical evolution to make predictions. And we don't have that for any scenario. That's really one of the problems we have to face up to and try to think hard about, although we can try to start thinking about toy models. But of course, there's an observational opportunity here because we can look for deviations now observationally. Particularly, we're interested in things sensitive to the plunge and merger phase of the gravitational wave, of the black hole collision. And you know, any deviation there, of course, observationally would be very exciting. So just to summarize, I've given you a simple and plausible set of postulates, two of which basically say that information can get in, but information that goes in must come out for unitarity. Secondly, the second set, including the correspondence with local quantum field theory, are together something like a weak quantum equivalence principle, if you think about it. I've told you that these lead to soft quantum structure of black holes or soft gravitational structure, and that very weak interactions can transfer enough information out, contrary to some prior thinking. And of course, there's an interesting connection with more general information theory problems. And of course, there are exciting prospects for observational probes of or constraints on this foundational problem, either through very long baseline interferometry or gravitational wave observation. And then finally, I'll end with some of the theory questions remaining, you know, refining our description of this, you know, enhanced transfer due to the large number of states, a better understanding of how observable scenarios should be, and of course, going beyond what I've said, basically an effective field theory kind of a description to a more complete description. So I'll stop there since I think I've used up my time. Thanks.
Let's say 100 black hole merger observations from now, we really definitely rule out soft structures to say less than 1/100th the distance, the size of black hole, and we rule out echoes from Planck scale structures to something smaller than the Planck scale outside the horizon. I mean, this could be possible. What would that then do in terms of these general like ideas about the black hole information paradox? Would this rule out any of these long cherished assumptions or beliefs about?
Well, okay, first, I'm not sure if you really, if we really will be able to rule out all of those things with observations. There is a general issue that it's hard to see things that are, roughly speaking, you know, inside the light ring. And so if you have a departure from the standard story that is, you know, in a sufficiently compact region, you know, that's something we're still exploring. You know, how, what can we see and what can't we see? Of course, the problem being that, you know, the important part of the signal could go into the final black hole. So there's a question, how much can we rule out, and and what won't we be able to rule out? And there's the associated question of, you know, for a given scenario, how strong of a departure in the signal do we predict? And I think it's early days, you know, that's sort of what I'm alluding to here. I think it's early days to really definitively answer those questions.
So I want to dig into this question about how you're evading the small corrections theorem.
Mm-hmm.
So
no, I'm not. So, well, it's not evading it.
Well,
it's you need an order.
Adding a piece to the Hamiltonian. So
yes.
There's still the original Hamiltonian, which is say free scalar fields in the vicinity of a black hole.
Sure. Yeah.
So there's still going to be the ordinary Hawking process creating incoherent pairs, and then in addition, you say there's this additional process. There's additional piece to the Hamiltonian, which is somehow transferring information.
Yeah.
So it sounds like for there to be not a problem, this additional piece to the Hamiltonian has to be taking the incoherent pairs, taking the one that fell into the black hole, and transferring its information non-locally back outside the horizon at strength of order one. Is that right?
Well, let's be a little more sharp about what we need. So what we need is an order one change in the outgoing radiation. Okay, because basically we want to turn something that didn't have any information, you know, it was entangled with the stuff inside, we want to turn that into a different state that is carrying out information.
Right.
And that's the state, that's what Samir calls his theorem. It actually goes back to Don's argument that there needs to be an order one departure.
But it sounds like you're adding some process on top of incoherent pair production. So if there's half the radiation comes out and it's carrying information, and then another half corresponding to the original Hawking process is incoherent, then you're still in trouble.
Well, okay, so the point is I have the right size, and that's all I'm checking at this stage, that we have the right size effect, and namely, there's an effect here from HI, as I showed, you know, that's large enough to, in principle, imprint, you know, one bit of information per, say, Hawking quantum emitted, okay, and that's the right size. That's what we need. And this Hamiltonian is big enough to do that with these small couplings. Okay, so that's the non-trivial thing here. You can get an order one effect, but with tiny couplings. And again, that's because of the transitions, well, because of the statement that you're making transitions involving a huge number of final states when you look at the black hole state.
Can you say that for the discussion?
You said that, okay, you wanted this change of momentum to be of order one over R. Is
yes.
it conceivable that that might apply to the whole gravitational mode? I mean, the gravitational mode in the LIGO season has a huge number of gravitons in it. But would you think that you should have delta P as 1 over R for each graviton in the mode? Or could it that just be the total? Or could it be the multiply that by the square root of N? I mean, in other words, you might not, if it could be smaller, if it could be reduced that way, you maybe wouldn't see any observable effect if it's delta P for the whole mode is 1 over R.
Yeah, I think, it needs more careful analysis.
Right.
But I think the right way of doing it is, again, to look at scattering, you know, from waves, well, essentially where you have an incoming and outgoing graviton and you're looking at the modification to that amplitude that you have from this. And, you know, I think you can potentially, say, change the absorption, say, probabilities versus scattering probabilities by an order one amount through this. And so, you know, that could, certainly could show up in the LIGO signal if you're doing that mode, you know, in a given mode, say. Now, one of the problems is, again, all of this could be taking place sort of close enough in, say, within the light ring that we, you know, maybe we're not so sensitive to it outside. But anyway, more analysis is needed to really answer that well.
Maybe a last question here. Can you comment on the relationship between this soft quantum black hole structure and the story about soft charges? that could be deposited, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's actually another talk. You know, there's not time for that. But, well, this comes back to the subtlety in how you think about subsystems in quantum gravity. And in some recent work we did that I alluded to, we've basically shown that there is, you know, at least at some level in an approximation, a way of thinking about subsystems in quantum gravity such that you can have a lot of states in a region and not just through the traditional story of, say, soft hair, et cetera, be sensitive to the details of that state from outside, okay? And so in that sense, we seem to be providing an argument against being able to detect or imprint information via the soft quantum hair, okay? That's the bottom line. I think at least we've seen the outlines of an argument or a partial argument that you can have a large number of states that don't make themselves evident through soft quantum hair, and so that doesn't solve the problem. That's the essence of it. And so you need something else.
Okay. Let's see you again.